Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
And greetings, Earth Explorers all over the world. So glad to have you here with us tonight. June 17th, 2012, coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, still about 78 degrees and clear. Nice Carolina blue skies. Speaking of blue skies, there are four sunspot clusters on the sun today. Sunspot 1504 has gamma beta magnetic field that poses a threat for strong M-class solar flares. So really there are four giant sunspot clusters that are aimed just slightly slightly west of Earth. There will be more coming over the limb of the sun tomorrow. But these sunspot clusters are not ordinary sunspots. These are high-latitude sunspots, and they're huge. They're hundreds of times the size of Earth, and they really can pack a punch. The solar wind today is a blistering 469 kilometers per second, and the proton count is the highest I have ever seen in all the years that I've been watching it. It is 10 protons per cubic centimeter. Now, I don't know what this means, but it's about 100 times the concentration we normally see from the sun. Normally, we see about 0.1, 0.2, 0.4, something like that. But to see 10 is very high, and to see a solar wind consistently over 450 kilometers per second is really high as well. There is a coronal hole aimed at Earth, and solar cycle 2013 is coming in to its full age here. I would like to thank everybody for this last Wednesday on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. We had quite an audience. I haven't been on there in probably a little over a year. George and I always get along really well, and 3 hours goes quicker than you know. Estimates, somewhere between 17 and 20 million people heard the program. Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, my latest book, made it to number one on Amazon. And I greatly appreciate that. It's holding at number five now. For a few glorious hours, it outsold all the books that are in the government and politics genre. And it does seem as though the book is getting out there to the right people. I spoke about, a week and a half ago, about the Control-Alt-Delete plan. The Control-Alt-Delete plan, those of you that own computers know what happens when your computer locks up. You hit Control-Alt-Delete, your task manager comes up, and you can go and stop programs that are locking up the computer. And at the very worst, you can go back to a previous date when the computer was operating fine, sort of like a going back in time when everything was working just fine, or backspacing through a game of chess before you hit checkmate so that you can choose a new strategy. I shared this Control-Alt-Delete plan with a couple of the campaigns out there. It made it so fast up the chain, I could not believe it, because literally the next day after I shared the plan, Mitt Romney took the podium and said that one of the first things he would do when elected is to rescind or repeal all the Obama-era regulations. That's exactly what the Control-Alt-Delete plan calls for. It calls for rescinding all regulations written by all the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations after the date of December 31st, 2007. This effectively goes back to an operating system where everything was working. Yes, we ended up making our way pretty close to checkmate. We may have even lost our queen in the process. But we can backspace back before that, and we can avert it. We can change that future, and it's within our power to do it. And as you know, the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations write up to 600 regulations a month that have the force of law. You are not represented in that government. You have no say in that government. And neither does Congress. When the rules come out, we have to comply with them, and they have the right to enforce those regulations by coming after you for fines or charging you fees or sending the whatever agency police after you, whether it's taxes or food police or drug police or whoever, and shut you down. That has brought the revenue engine of America to a grinding halt. And as the water wheel that distributes wealth around the world comes to a stop, every business, every country that relies upon cash flowing through the system begins to run into each other or one another like dominoes. And that's exactly what we see. The weaker, more service-oriented countries go first, like Greece and Spain and et cetera, states behind that. And make no mistake, all of this global catastrophe originated in the United States, carried around to the weaker structures, and then came back around to us. So everything that we are doing to stop the commerce in our country is having a global effect. And what we need to do is take the brakes off of the water wheel and let it start turning again. Once it starts turning again, once you get government out of the way of the entrepreneurial and innovative mind of Americans, we'll take care of the rest. We'll get the wheel moving. All government has to do is get out of the way. So, needless to say, the book is selling pretty well this week. I would very much like it if the sales kept going. Not so much for the revenue, although it's substantial. But for the idea to get out there because it's so timely. So if you bought a copy and you have it in your financial ability, buy another one and give it away. Tell a friend. Keep it going. Go back to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and write a review for the book. Help someone else. Some of the mail that I've gotten has been nothing short of phenomenal. People are a third of the way through the book and are saying things like bravo and, you know, finally, it's not just one sledgehammer after another beating up the administration or beating up the president or beating up this cabinet member or that cabinet member or Congress. It's not blame, blame, blame. The book has solutions. It offers solutions, viable solutions to our problems. And if the American people will get behind it, call their governors and call their congressmen and call their senators, we can make it happen. We can save this planet. So just to let you know, we have a lot of new listeners this week, obviously, because of the recent exposure. I want to let you know, give you a little bit more information about the two upcoming conferences. One is in October. It's called the Pythagoras Conference. It's in the Midwest, southern Indiana. You can find out about it by going to xsquaredradio.com, clicking on the blue banner. And all you have to do, when you click on that, you'll get $100 off because you're going in through X Squared Radio. But this is a conference you don't have to fly to and you don't have to drive to, so it can save you hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. And you're going to get exposed to 50 of some of the top speakers in the world, nationally and internationally, in this genre. If you want something a little more aggressive, and I highly recommend that you do, and you have a passport, or you can get a passport by this December, you can take off with us and go to Chichen Itza, which is ground zero for, you guessed it, Maya 2012. with Power Places, and you know the reputation of Power Places, world class. Everyone that goes to a Power Places presentation comments on the professionalism, on the depth of the experience, on the attention to detail. These are a tremendous value. So Power Places is putting on Maya 2012, myself, Greg Braden, Maureen St. Germain, some of the Mayan elders are, and others are going to be at Chichen Itza, ground zero, for the entire 2012 event. We're leaving on, I believe, the 13th of December, and we will be back on the 22nd of December. We'll spend the 21st down there. It'll culminate that evening. So you will be at ground zero when the Maya calendar resets, and you will be home for Christmas. And man, will you have stories to tell, and great pictures and great videos. We're going to sing, we're going to dance, we're going to talk, we're going to see presentations that will change your life. Maya 2012. Click on the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com and get registered today. Now, to the news. As we have talked about on this program from time to time, on the subject of climate change, not global warming, that's sort of the political name for what's going on, but climate change. Excuse me while I sip some wonderful grapefruit juice. Incidentally, this week was my first week without a cast on my right leg, and it feels wonderful. Oh, yeah, even the skin is starting to look like a normal human skin again. And in 10 days, I get this awful neck brace off, so I can, you'll notice a difference because I'll be able to turn my head to the right and left. It'll make a big difference in the program. I appreciate all your cards and letters, and especially your thoughts and your prayers, because I feel them. It has definitely made a difference, and those that are in care of me have noticed that bones are mending, and road rash is going back to normal skin at a much satisfying rate. So as we talk about climate change, one of the things that becomes a subject matter of our scientific expedition above the Arctic Circle next year. Oh, that was the other thing we did on Wednesday night. We made a global announcement, exclusive, that the expedition is on, that we have a Park Avenue production company in New York that has agreed to pay the charter on the boat. We still have to come up with the $350,000 or so to get all the scientists and observers and filmmakers and that from their locations all over the world, France, California, Washington State, Pennsylvania, New York, etc., from their homes to Murmansk, Russia, and then back again once the boat arrives back and the train takes us back to St. Petersburg. We have been very blessed with some small donations and reasonable size donations, and our gratitude goes out to those people who've felt that call. It is most appreciated, and you have now become a part of history. We now have your email addresses as well, and I promise that you will be over-rewarded for your donation, much beyond what you ever expected. Part of that expedition, one of the scientific themes of what we're doing in this expedition, there are five of them, is the effect of climate change on the Arctic Circle. Now, this isn't the tourist Arctic Circle. This isn't the one you get to see when you go to Iceland or you take the North Pole cruise, which are pretty well mapped out sea lanes. This is a destination that no one goes. This is not a sea lane to anywhere. It broke open in 2007 when the Arctic ice cap calved, like, you know, a cow will have a calf. When it calves, there's a crack that forms that can be, you know, hundreds of kilometers long. And when the crack forms, a giant shelf, sometimes 100 or 500 feet thick, will break off. And you have a state size a chunk of ice go floating off into the sea, like a giant flat iceberg. That will eventually break up into smaller icebergs and then melt into warmer oceans. Well, that's what happened in 2007. This piece about the size of the state of Pennsylvania broke off. A combination of warming and a sustained wind that created stress across the ice literally ripped off a piece of the cap. When that happened, it opened up an area of the Arctic Circle that has not been open, it's estimated, in about 200,000 years. Well, this particular sea area does not lead to anywhere. In other words, putting a boat in, it's not going to take you to, China or Japan by sailing from eastern Canada. So, therefore, no ships have sailed it. And there are really only two ships that are capable of safely navigating these waters that are civilian. And they both belong to the Russians. They both belong to the Murmansk Shipping Company. Both of these ships are former Soviet vessels. They now belong to private enterprises in Russia. They're decades and decades old. But they're legendary in their ability to handle thick ice and be able to venture where no other ice-rated hull boats can go. They do have the ability to stay at sea for extended periods of time. Some of them are nuclear-powered, so they literally have a 3-year fuel supply on board. If you could keep enough food to keep 250 people alive for that long, it could literally stay at sea that long, generating electricity from fission reactors on board. So we are taking scientists from several universities, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, and Washington universities so far, and as well as a historic team, a metaphysical team, and a filmmaking team, and we're going to go searching for the legendary opening into the interior of the Earth. Some people call it the journey to the center of the Earth. It is not. We're not going to sail this giant ship inside the Earth. But we are going to look for the opening. We have a helicopter on the ship. We have another boat on the ship. And we are going to do a very legitimate, very high scientific expedition to search for evidence. One of those themes during this evidentiary venture is to search for effects of global warming above the Arctic Circle. One of those effects, and this has been discovered as a joint venture through NASA, is that their thinning Arctic ice allows plankton to bloom. Now, scientists have discovered new blooms of microscopic plant life in the Arctic, but they have not sailed that far north. These are lower latitude Arctic sampling of plankton, and if it's this much where the sea has always been open. Imagine what it is where the sea has never been open before, and now it has sunlight. Scientists who traveled to the Arctic on a NASA research cruise last summer were looking for signs of climate change. What they found was a secret world hidden beneath the region's cap of sea ice. During their travels through the Kukchi Sea off the coast of Alaska, they were stunned to find massive blooms of phytoplankton under the ice. In water, so teeming with the microscopic plant life that turned it an opaque, vivid green, the discovery upends the notion that the sea ice that forms in autumn ushers in a cold, dark, and nearly lifeless season for the ocean below. Dr. Don Perovich said, "This is what you live for as a scientist." He's a sea expert at Dartmouth College and a co-author of the study published yesterday in the journal Science. "It's unexpected," he said. "It's pure discovery. This is exactly what we have been talking about with our expedition. We're going someplace no one has ever sailed before. We're going to see waters that have never been seen by human eyes before." So, Dr. Perovich, if you want to join us from Dartmouth College, we'd be happy to make you the fifth educational institution that participates in this expedition. Lead author Kevin Arrigo, a biological oceanographer at Stanford University, said the findings amount to a fundamental shift in our understanding of Arctic ecosystems. All I can say, Kevin, is no kidding. Clearly, there are parts of the Arctic Ocean that are much more biologically productive than we thought, he said. The scientists believe the blooms are a result of changes in the region's sea ice, which is receding and thinning as the climate warms. Decades ago, there would have been thick multi-layer ice in this area, maybe 3 meters thick, Arrigo said. There is no way there would have been sunlight getting through ice that thick to have a bloom like this. But these days, the portion of the Chukchi Sea the scientists studied is covered with 3 foot, 1 meter thick ice that forms in the fall and melts in the spring. More sunlight equals more phytoplankton. It's able to penetrate that thinner ice, an effect compounded by declines in snowfall and a proliferation of melt ponds on the ice surface. Those ponds are windows from the sky to the ocean, Perovich said. They transmit about 50% of the sunlight that's visible on the surface through the ice to the ocean below. That light, combined with nutrient-rich waters under the ice, is a recipe for phytoplankton explosion. The amount of phytoplankton in this bloom, top to bottom, is more than has ever been seen in any bloom anywhere in the world in open water, said Arrigo, who has studied phytoplankton for 25 years. He compares the phytoplankton-filled water to pea soup. The dense blooms, more than 150 feet deep in places, extended from the ice edge more than 70 miles into the interior of the ice pack. Although the researchers examined a small portion of the Chukchi Sea, they believe that in roughly 25% of the Arctic, conditions are ripe for similar plankton mega blooms. Well, some 8,000 miles away, on the other side of Canada, in the Russian waters, exactly the same conditions exist, Mr. Arrigo. We want you to come with us. We'll show you waters that you've never seen before. The possibility that the phenomenon is so widespread suggests scientists have underestimated the amount of carbon dioxide pulled into the Arctic Ocean by phytoplankton, which pulled CO2 from the atmosphere to make energy and animals that consume them. So in other words, the greenhouse gas CO2, which is mostly put out by coal-fired power plants, is being metabolized just fine by Arctic phytoplankton. And the blooms may play into a growing disconnect between the coming of spring and the annual northward journey of wildlife seeking a tasty phytoplankton meal. In other words, once the giant mammals that feed off the phytoplankton, as well as other fish, discover that the bloom is there, it doesn't take very long with a ready food supply. The Arctic's open water plankton blooms now begin about a month earlier than they did in the 1990s, a consequence of the warming climate. Scientists worry that it's throwing off the timing of migratory animals like Arctic terns, snow geese, and California gray whales that once arrived to feed at the height of the year during the phytoplankton bloom. Since that bloom is changing, their date of arrival will change. The discovery that massive blooms of plankton begin before Arctic sea ice starts to melt in the spring changes the picture slightly. Well, I know where this article is going with this, but I want to parenthetically put in this thought. Just suppose that this phytoplankton blooming pattern continues for, let's say 10 years. Hold on one moment. Let's say that the conditions of global warming, excess greenhouse emissions, have an effect on phytoplankton blooms in the Arctic for 10 years, and the gray whales and the other migratory animals respond to that by coming earlier and earlier, thinking, well, we can have more young. It is a natural thing for migratory animals to adapt to their environment over time. Now, let's suppose that they start arriving 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks early to take advantage of this bloom, you know, the early bird sort of thing. And then all of a sudden we have a harsh winter. We do have a thick snowfall. The ice does go back to 3 meters, and the phytoplankton does not bloom. And what happens is the mammals show up and the birds show up, and all these migratory animals show up, and the water is antiseptic.
PBSRadio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information and knowledge bring humanity closer to truth.
Sorry about that, Earth Explorers. Not really sure what happened there, but that was surely strange. We're going along eating cookies, drinking milk, and all of a sudden the sound quit working. I could hear me, but you could not, so it just all of a sudden went silent. I'm not really sure what you missed. It was probably the most important part. I'm kidding. Under ice blooms are going to be good for anything that eats off the bottom, Mr. Arrigo said, because they begin where there are fewer predators in the water column to consume the plankton, meaning more of the tiny organisms will fall to the floor. That's great for clams, gray whales, walruses, eider ducks, but puffins, terns, and other animals that eat plankton-munching fish may lose out because they cannot penetrate even the thin sea ice. But it's not clear how those winners and losers will interact to reshape the Arctic ecosystem, said Walker Smith, a marine scientist at the College of William and Mary who contributed to the study. We can't really give a good prediction of the effect of the shifting on food webs yet. Now, all of this was predicted as a symptom of climate change. If you'll recall, if you read the book The Coming Global Superstorm, and this was by Art Bell and Whitley Strieber a number of years back, they talked about this as one of the symptoms of climate change. The increase in plankton will produce a bloom in fish population, which will result in record harvests in the near future for fisheries. The ocean's crystallinity and salinity will change as well. This will change the way it absorbs and stores energy from the sun, which will result in a change in the Gulf Stream. And what I mean by that is that the Gulf Stream operates off of thermoclines, layers of warm and cold water that move, pump by thermal action, large amounts of water, like a river, an ocean river above and below the sea, to spread life throughout the planet. This temperature differential between the two layers of ocean, deep and near the surface, will change the way life is pumped throughout the planet. Now, the question in most people's minds is whether humans had anything to do with this or not. Well, in a way, yes. All the planets in the solar system are warming. That probably is not in the hands entirely of humans. But when the planet warms and it creates a change in conditions, for instance, thinning ice in the Arctic, the addition of CO2, not in a acute manner, the way, say, a volcanic reaction would do, if a volcano erupted, it would pump a gob of CO2 into the atmosphere, but all at once. And so the ecosystem would just absorb it and go on. But a chronic exposure to excess CO2 from hundreds and hundreds of giant CO2 or coal-burning plants pumping out CO2 all over the planet, this amount of CO2 in a constant flow now gets into, it supersaturates the water, which supersaturates the ice. It gets in the rain and falls out of the sky as a form of CO2-laden water, because as you know, Dalton's law, the law of partial pressures, if you have a certain amount of gases in a headspace, the liquid in that headspace will have a like proportion of those gases. So CO2 will be in the rainwater that drops into the ocean, the snow that lands on the ice on the ocean and eventually melts into the water. And so this chronic exposure to CO2 does have an effect on the ecosystem. This blooming of phytoplankton is not just a result of sunlight getting into the water. It's the availability of the extra carbon in the form of CO2, which is readily usable by the phytoplankton to make energy, to make sugar, to make food, and thus allow itself to blossom, to grow at a rapid rate. We also know that one of the other things that has an effect on phytoplankton and sea algae is the timing of light. Light 24 hours a day does not have nearly as beneficial effect as somewhat filtered light or flashing light, which is more what you would get under a thin layer of ice. Because of wind blowing across the water, across the ice, snow patches and clear ponds on the water, and the ocean currents flowing underneath the phytoplankton receive a stage of lighting that is full on light and then a slight amount of shade. And this has a blooming effect on these microorganisms. The other question is whether this can be monetized for political power and money. And I guess we have seen plenty of that on both sides of the aisle, both sides of the argument. Still, the scientific community has taken quite a beating one way and the other for playing the game in the first place, I suppose. Science, as usual, will wait until the dust clears before offering any perspective on what could have been done to save the race or save the planet. But it's always after we push the button that the sanity is preached. I suppose it's much easier to be believed when there are gravestones to add to the equation. Obviously, the number of dead and the manner of their demise is directly proportional to the action people will attempt to avert such a calamity or to try to reverse what has happened, until they forget about it, of course. Once the batteries that run the camera lights run down, they'll forget about it. But then they're ready to do it all over again, and usually faster than before. Oh, yeah, we had that cataclysm, but we lived. You know, we made it through it. Don't count out the agency government either. I'm sure they'll be the first in line to write all kinds of new regulations. We have already seen various administrations make their play to get as many regulations in place as they can to block such activities. We've even heard the replay of campaign speeches that have been made in the last little bit where they've said, oh, yeah, you can go ahead and build a coal-fired power plant. You can if you want. That's no problem. You won't be able to run it because we're going to sue you out of existence, but you can build it. And that's exactly what we're seeing happen. So the agency government is all over this. All right. So that is enough of global warming, climate change, and the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. Although I have to say, you know, George was very gracious, and we spoke about the expedition for about 15 minutes on broadcast radio. Broadcast radio is different than webcast radio, although my producers and I at BBS Radio, we feel the same way about this. You know, when a listener is listening to AM radio, they're listening to Coast on AM radio. Normally, a person listening to AM radio or FM radio has a steering wheel in their hands or is doing something other than sitting at the computer. Our audience, our listener, is sitting there with a PC or a laptop or a Mac in front of them with a credit card in their hands. So we have a much more ready buying audience than they do. Of course, we don't have 695 stations simultaneously carrying the program from coast to coast, hence the name Coast to Coast AM. It used to be called the Art Bell Show. But we are on every single computer in the world, which I think there are a lot more computers than there are AM radios these days. The issue, of course, is competition. Everyone else is on everyone else's computer as well, and there are a lot of choices. So what we have done over the last now almost 7 years, this September will be 7 years that we've been on the air. That's just amazing to me. And the audience has grown and then moved on and grown and moved on. And it does that because people develop different habits. They get different jobs. They have to sleep at night. They do different things with their Sunday evenings, especially when football season's on. But what we try to do here is investigate the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And we don't always stick with science, although we are a scientific talk radio program. All kinds of things fit into the genre of science. All kinds of things can be studied in that manner. And political science is one of those things. Do we get into the politics, bashing one party back and forth with another? No. But we do talk about the effects of politics on government, because government and the effect of how it runs in society, how government functions in the sociology of the human condition, is definitely of interest to us. And we know that you have strong opinions out there because you write them to me, and I like that. You can write them to me at Skype at BAgnew@X2-Radio, or you can write me at BAgnew@X2-Radio.com or X2-Radio.com, or you can do the next best thing, actually the primary thing, that the reason we're here live every Sunday night. You can call me. Toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. And we've made it so easy for you to listen. For one, we have created at xsquaredradio.com a Droid app for you. So all you have to do is click on the app on the left-hand side of the website there, and accept it on your Droid phone, and all you have to do then is just click on the icon and boom, you're listening. We have created a conference line for you so that you can listen with your cell phone on a giant conference call. Now, you can't interact with the program, but you can listen to the program, and that number is 760-569-7676, 760-569-7676. And then the passcode 192919#. And all of this information is at bbsradio.com channel 2 and also at xsquaredradio.com right on the cover on the left-hand side. All kinds of ways that you can participate. My favorite, of course, is if you call. And we'll discuss it. I want to hear your opinions. I want to hear your insight. And so do all the listeners that are out there. We have varying amounts of listeners that listen live on Sunday evening. And as I said, there is a lot of competition, especially when the weather's nice outside. But we have literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of listeners over time that listen to the archives. These go live tonight, and they're listened to tomorrow morning when hundreds of thousands of people go to work. They turn on their computers. They put on their headphones or their earbuds, and they listen to the program while they're working on their favorite project. So if you want to be part of the program, if you want your voice to get out there, you want your thoughts to get out there, this is the place. You have ready access. We'll take a break at the top of each hour, but other than that, it's wide open, just you and me talking about the news of the day and the way that it affects the science of the human condition on this planet and others, if that's what you want to talk about. And in our next hour, I want to start talking about the drone wars. We have covered this since, drones started being the way of life, I guess, in warfare. A couple of my friends and some of the plants that I've actually had to shut down and relocate and put into other kinds of business now work at drone plants. I know, it sounds so strange. Where do you work? Oh, we build drones. Yeah, there are half a dozen big drone manufacturers here in the United States, a couple of them Israeli-owned. And some of these drones are quite pricey. The Predator drone is a little over $4 million a copy. Believe it. Yeah, $4 million a copy. And a couple of weeks ago, we covered the new legislation that is going to allow, now it's not implemented yet, but it's going to be, 30,000 drones, not over the battlefield, over America. Oh, you've heard it on the news, but you're going to get the details here. You're going to find out how that's going to be implemented, who's going to be using it, why they're going to be using it. And it's not just border patrol. It's patrol of your highways, your farmland, your factories. The things that go on behind your fence are now going to be watched with high-resolution drones. And they might say that, oh, yes, we have to have a warrant, we have to have a reason. We can't do incidental observations, but let me tell you something. If they're flying over your fenced in area and they see you doing something on that fenced area or somebody doing something on your land and it catches the interest of law enforcement or any of the agencies that have access to the data, be it the USDA, the Bureau of Land Management, the EPA, or any of the other management agencies that are out there that would be interested in what you're doing on your land, believe me, it won't take long, nor too many phone calls before they do have a warrant and they do have a reason and they will be back. And that has got people in ire, but not really enough to do anything about it. No more than the people in Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan that are being flown over right now. Occasionally they shoot one down. And occasionally they figure out how to hack into one and they land it. And I'm sure that's happening a lot more than they want to admit. But the drone wars have begun, okay? So Cyberdyne Systems is alive and well, I guess you could say. It is quite possible to put robots in the sky and beyond and beyond. Because one of the other things we're going to talk about in this hour is the mother of all drones, the XB-37. Yeah, the XB-37 is a drone, people. It is a unmanned space robot. And it just got done with an almost 12-month mission orbiting the Earth. And lots of strange things happening in that mission, by the way. It changed orbits. It is on a skewed orbit with what everyone thought it was up there to do, which was to watch the Chang'e Chinese space station, which means Heavenly Palace, by the way. But the orbits of the two craft were skewed, and thus, even if they were watching one another, they would only get about a 1 or 2 second view as they pass each other at about 17,000 miles an hour. Not conducive for spying on one another. But nevertheless, the super secret U.S. Air Force, it used to be NASA, but NASA ran out of money, and so the Air Force grabbed it, put it into their rapid deployment program with an unlimited budget, secret unlimited budget. We still don't know how much it cost. We still don't know what it's used for, and we have no idea what the payload or function of it was while it was up there for a year, and I doubt we ever will. Well, that is, unless, of course, Obama decides that it would make him look better as a president to tell us what it's been doing up there. Maybe we should just wait around. What do you say? Anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little music, relax, get a beverage, recline your chair, look out the window. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio right after this. And welcome back to X Squared Radio's second hour, June 17, 2012. So glad that you could be here with us tonight. You know, people ask me from time to time, how do I get everything done that I do? How do I get involved in all that I do? I'm just going to let a little music play in the background here. I find life to be amazing. Mortal life is phenomenal, the things that we are capable of participating in, the food that we get to taste, the music we get to listen to, the things that we get to see. I am utterly amazed at the beauty and grace and functionality of this planet. It is probably the most interesting place that I can consciously behold in my dreams or my thoughts. Unless I go way, way back before this life to other worlds. But even those wonderful, beautiful red trees and the gorgeous view over the water and the view of the planets in the sky and the giant sun pales in comparison to the beauty and balance of this planet. And the things that we get to participate in this planet go beyond our imagination. We only have to spend the energy in our life to catch up with our imagination, to do those things, to see those things, to experience and taste those things, for good or for ill. But the greatest calling of all, the greatest job, the greatest experience is to create life in your own image. To be a father. To have children. To see in their faces the wonder, the laughter, the discovery, to watch them when they sleep or when they play, to feel their hug around your neck, to watch their faces at Christmas time when they tear the paper off or taste a new food or wake up on a Saturday morning sleeping as late as they want. It is the experience of fatherhood. That is truly amazing. I've had 4 children and 3 wonderful grandchildren so far. And I would not trade that experience for all the galaxies, for all the things that I have tried and all the successes that I have had. I would not trade that, nor would you. So happy Father's Day, fathers, because this is godhood in embryo that you get to try. Oh, that you live up to it. Realize what you're doing, who you are touching, and how you are affecting the universe. Happy Father's Day. All right, let's move on this hour. Thank you very much, by the way, for listening and for being part of X Squared Radio, for being part of the BBS radio experience, because if it's not mainstream, it's right here. Mainstream, someone asked me the other day what I thought about it, and I said, well, I think of the mainstream as sort of a river, or a stream flowing from the mountains out to the sea. The only thing that moves with the stream out to sea is the dead stuff. It's just flowing downhill unless it snags up on something, and it's going to make it all the way to the sea and eventually be consumed. So the mainstream is going nowhere except out to sea to ignominy. It is the living, the choosing, the breathing, the conscious and aware that swim upstream. Because if nobody swims upstream, there will be no fish in the spring. That's you and me. That's why you're here. That's why you're listening to this program. That's what BBS Radio is. It isn't the mainstream. It's the upstream. You're going upstream, and you're making a difference in the ecosystem, in the ecological and economic engine of planet Earth. Welcome home. Drone wars are going on right before our very eyes. It is being driven by literally hundreds of billions of dollars of military money. Oh, yes, those factories are cranking out those drones. And, that a Predator drone costs about $4 million. The RQ-170, the one that the Iranians hacked into and landed, and the one that made quite a stir flying over the Beltway in D.C. this last week, they're even more expensive. They're not propeller-driven. They're jet-driven, and they're very sleek and stealthy, but they still showed up above the Beltway and caused quite a stir, ended up on a lot of people's cell phones on mainstream news. So it's being driven by money upstream, and as I've always told you, and you know to be true, it doesn't take a conflict to make a war. It only takes a weapon. And the folks at Wars R Us have a budget. Oh, yes, they have a budget. And they realize that if they don't make themselves useful, they're going to be swept out with all the other unuseful things. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it. That's the mantra. So if you have a military budget and you're spending it on drones, well, guess what's happening? Well, business is good. And as it turns out, the battlefield has all the drones it can use. In fact, there are not enough pilots to fly them, not enough missions to deploy them. Because those pesky drones, they don't have to take bathroom breaks. You don't have to pay the pilots very much. You can put them on autopilot most of the time. Some of the drones can stay up for days at a time. They've got giant drones that can stay up at 100,000 feet for up to 14 days in one stretch. 14 days. You can circumnavigate the globe with a drone. And now we have regulations, new laws that Congress is putting in place to allow municipalities all around the country to order up drones, to rent drones, and to even lease time from drone drivers. Oh, I like that. Drone driver. What do you do for a living? I'm a drone driver. That'd be a good bumper sticker, wouldn't it? Drone drivers sitting in the remote places like Nellis Air Force Base are just flying drones, looking out the camera, sitting in a chair with a joystick. And a lot of this can be run by computer because they have GPS. They know where the freeways are. They know what to do. And you know why local law enforcement wants them, right? Aha, that's exactly right. They want to monitor the freeways because they know when they hide a highway patrol car or a state trooper car on the freeway, they know what you do. You don't go speeding by that car. You slow down. And a lot of us have radar detectors, and a lot of us have radios and cell phones. And we have networks that apps now that locate police cars on the freeway. So you can avoid detection by simply slowing down within the eyesight or the detection zone of the individual state trooper. They can't be everywhere. And I've already told you for several years now how to break them, how to make it economically impossible for them to put the state troopers on the freeway in the first place. Right? You drive the speed limit. Because if they're not making any money on the freeways, they can't stay on the freeways. They got to go, well, they got to go enforce the law. They got to go catch bad guys. You can't be out on the freeway revenueing. But drones can, and drones you can't see because you're not looking up. And while you're driving down the freeway, you might say, oh, you know what, it's a little windy today. Yeah, it's a little overcast. It's a little cloudy. They're not going to have some Cessna up there with a guy hanging out with binoculars looking at those white stripes on the freeway going with a stopwatch. Oh, yeah, that guy's going 85 miles an hour. Let's get him. What kind of car is it? It's a Toyota. No, it's a Chevy. No, it's a Ford Audi. I'm not sure, but it's blue. A drone can tell. A drone can read your license plate from up there in the dark, in the rain, in the fog. And it can send that information to a highway patrolman ahead of you that's coordinating with that drone. And it says a 2005 Dodge Ram green license number, blah, 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 is coming your way. And right now he's doing 82 miles an hour. All he has to do is wait. You've already been identified. You've already been photographed. The photograph has already been sent to a screen on the highway patrol car, and he's going to pull you over and gather up his money. So these drones are going to generate millions of dollars a week in new revenue, and every sheriff's department in the country is getting in line. 30,000 drones. Count it up, people. Count it up. That's 600 drones for every state. And you know they're not going to be flying them over Hawaii, and they're not going to be flying them over Rhode Island. They're going to be flying them over Texas, over Oklahoma, over Nebraska, Kansas, areas where the freeways are so long and straight, it's unusual and cruel punishment to drive the speed limit across these states. Texas is getting ready to implement the nation's first 85-mile-an-hour speed limit. Believe it, 85, which means people are going to add 10. They're going to be driving 95 miles an hour. 95. That's the Autobahn across Texas. But have you ever driven east to west, I-40 across Texas? Yeah, it's cruel and unusual punishment to drive from Arizona to Tennessee on 40 at the speed limit. You have to speed. It's inhuman not to speed. After a while, 70 miles an hour looks like you could get out and walk faster than that car is moving. But the drones are watching. And after a while, they're going to make so much money that they'll pay for the drones. Well, tapped prosecutors to investigate information, and you know what? It's true. Well, yeah, very good. Excellent. It was no longer classified. That's exactly right. The president declassified the information and then he leaked it. Sorry, no harm, no foul. Sorry, not classified anymore. We didn't leak any classified. The notion that my White House would intentionally leak classified information, I find offensive. Listen to the words very carefully. Intentionally leaked? No. Classified information? Absolutely not. He declassified the information. No crime was committed. The Homeland Security Department ordered so many drones that it cannot keep them all flying. And it doesn't have a good plan for how to use them, according to a new audit that the department's inspector general released Monday. You remember that we talked about the Homeland Security budget on this program, and I posted it for you directly from their website in the book Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. The Homeland Security's annual budget for 2012 is posted as $89 billion. And keep in mind, 85% of that money is discretionary, which means the secretary can decide at a moment's notice where that money is to be spent. There is no, that's like having no budget. I'm serious. That's like saying, John, we're going to give you $50,000 a month and a very strict budget. But $45,000 a month of this money is discretionary. You just have to tell us where you're going to spend it. It's an open expense account for you, but you got to make sure that we know where you spent the money. You mean I don't have any guidelines where I can spend the money? No guidelines at all. Just whatever you think is important for the day, just make sure that you record where you spend it. Keep your receipts. So if they don't have a good plan for how to use them, and they got all these drones sitting around, guys, Earth explorers, they're not going to sit around in the hangar. They're not going to be hangar queens. I mean, come on, the drone companies, right? We created all these jobs. We're cranking these puppies out. We've got to put them to work. We've got to surveil something. In a blunt assessment, investigators said Customs and Border Protection's Office of Air and Marine has a fleet of 9 unmanned aircraft systems and is awaiting a 10th, though it doesn't have enough ground support and doesn't have a good plan for prioritizing missions. CBP, that's the Customs and Border Protection, procured unmanned aircraft before implementing adequate plans, the investigator said. I'm sure what happened is the Department of Homeland Security said, hey, listen, we're going to build 10 more drones. Who wants them? Oh, we'll take some. We'll take some. Okay, great. We'll put your name in. And that's all that was said. Well, what are you going to do with them? Don't know yet. Don't have a plan, but we'll take them. The Defense Department uses armed drones overseas in the war on terrorism. Isn't that a little like a war on jealousy, a war on anger? That is just really strange. Hold on 1 second. It looks like we're being hacked. Hold on. We've made some changes to the websites, all of them. Updates to NIPI.org, that's the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.org. You might want to go there and check things out. We have made a global announcement that the funding has been procured for the ship charter through a major Park Avenue, New York studio. Right now they're on location filming for this year's budget, which they have already allocated. Next year, July, August 2013. All right, it looks like we're back. July, August 2013, the expedition is on through our Park Avenue, New York studio. All right, sorry about that, live listeners. This is some things that happen. We have people out there that are highly skilled with nothing better to do with their time than mess with the free press, and they have managed to get into the computers at PBS Radio, upset the live stream. And so we had to reboot and go around it. It is shenanigans. We don't know what the activity is, but it's going to take them the rest of the program to figure out. We have the smartest producers on the West Coast. So we're back live. What I was talking to you about is the Defense Department uses armed drones overseas in the war on terrorism. And I had mentioned that that's a little like a war on jealousy or a war on anger or a war on obesity. But American law enforcement agencies are increasingly turning to them for use in detecting or preventing crimes at home. Translation. They want to use the drones for traffic surveillance so that they can catch more people speeding, so that they can assess more fines against drivers. Because they know that drivers have visual contact, they have radar contact, they flash lights between one another as an expression of free speech, and they communicate with now phone apps that locate and distribute the location of highway patrol. But drones are almost undetectable. And at night or in foggy days or cloudy days, they're up there and they can read your license plate number from 20,000 feet up. You'll never see them. But what they'll do is discover your vehicle, radio it ahead to and your photograph to a highway patrol car, which will go out and then serve you the bill. So it will greatly increase the revenuing. Now, the inspector general said that given the number of aircraft, CBP, that's Border Protection, Customs and Border Protection, should have been able to fly more than 10,000 hours of missions per year, but in the year under review, the agency flew less than 4,000 hours. Well, you know what this means. Underscoring the ad hoc approach, and I told you ad hoc is a little like saying, what do you want to do today? I don't know. What do you want to do? That's ad hoc. The agency doesn't have a dedicated budget for running drones and has had to siphon money from other areas to keep the program afloat. Well, that's until they start pulling in massive amounts of revenue from the highways, because they're going to be able to write 10 times, 20 times, 50 times more citations. That money is going to go back into the program. Investigators said the budget woes mean future missions may have to be scrapped, yet the underfunded fleet continues to grow. Well, you know what's going to happen. Eventually, the drone builders are going to be put out of business. Quote, despite the current underutilization of unmanned aircraft, CBP received two additional aircraft in late 2011 and was awaiting delivery of a 10th aircraft in 2012. Since fiscal year 2004, when CBP conducted its first pilot study of using drones, the federal government has spent $240.6 million on the program. By the way, as I mentioned before, each Predator B drone cost about $14 million. That's right, $14 bucks for one drone. CBP has flown missions for the Texas Rangers, the U.S. Forest Service, the FBI, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the latter of which wanted video of dams, bridges, and levees where flooding was occurring. Investigators also said CBP, at the behest of the State Department, has held, quote, discussions with another country on the use of unmanned aircraft, close quote. In its official response to the report, CBP said it is trying to update its planning to get its fleet in the air more, and said it is trying to request the right budget. The agency also said it won't expand beyond 10 drones unless directed to do so by a higher authority. We have already told you that there is a law on the books, or there is a law in process that will authorize 30,000 drones over the United States for surveillance. And I told you already that's 600 drones per state. And I told you that Rhode Island, Hawaii, you know, these areas aren't going to get drones. These drones are going to be over flyover country where people are really driving fast. They're going to be over Atlanta and Florida. They're going to be over Pennsylvania, Nebraska, Kansas, Texas, long stretches of California, Indiana, places where they can't afford to put a highway patrol car, and they constantly have to move them because as soon as one parks, every CB within 20 miles goes off, and everybody knows where they are, and guess what? That's right, double nickels. Everybody's driving the speed limit when they go by, hence no revenue. CBP uses drones to help a patrol along the country's borders, with the agency saying they assist in looking for potential terrorists and illegal cross-border activity. Although, with last Friday's law being executive order being signed into law, Hispanics that are under the age of 30, I don't know how in the world you're going to be able to prove whether they're 28 or 32, if they don't have any identification on them, and they've been in the country since they were 16, and they have either served in the military or they have advanced their education, you can't deport them. Rush Limbaugh is now calling this the catch, release, and vote plan. Drones are also stationed in Florida and Texas to help with maritime operations. In other words, boats going back and forth between Cuba and the United States. So, with the agency talking in, I think, poor faith in this article about expanding to 10 drones and, oh, gee, we just don't have the missions enough for 10 drones to fly. There's going to be 600 drones in each state. There will hardly be a square mile that is not covered by drones at some time of the night or day. And they're going to know which political party you belong to, whether you belong to the NRA, AMAC, AARP, or whether you have been photographed at a recent Occupy America rally. Let's take a phone call. Roland from L.A. on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing tonight, Brooke?
I'm doing great.
I had a quick question about last week. We were talking about how, how the business atmosphere, it wasn't regulated. It's causing Congress to push against businesses a little bit hard. What was it you used instead of regulation?
I know what we were talking about, but you know, business is regulated in several ways. One is access to capital. The other is all kinds of regulations that apply to the specific business. For instance, in our business, it's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. In others, like say you're a small chef and you want to move from catering out of your home to catering out of a commercial kitchen. Well, now you have to fill out zoning paperwork, and you have to undergo a series of inspections and then regular inspections thereafter. So all of this is covered under the USDA and the health department. So there are tons of regulations that businesses now have to comply with.
About this problem, the regulations imposed December 1st, would that be the proper way to address it?
Yes, I think so. I call that the Control-Alt-Delete plan. And
I didn't remember if you used another word rather than regulations.
No, it is the regulations. What we're doing is rescinding, we're asking Congress or the president, the new president once he's elected, to rescind all regulations written after December 31st, 2007.
Perfect. That's exactly what I was putting together in a letter for both U.S. senators here in California and also my local congressman.
Well, I sent it to the presidential candidates, and through Rand Paul, it made it to Mitt Romney's campaign, and the next day he added that to a speech that one of his first orders of business is to repeal all Obama-era regulations.
All right. So that was in a speech.
Yeah, it's having its effect. I'm telling you, smart ideas like this, when they get out, smart people know what to do with them. The idea is to get the ideas out there where they can use them.
Right. Just put it out there to where they can pick it up and go with it.
Yeah, and the idea is to get government out of the way of business. Now, I'm not talking about dirty air and dirty water and throwing grandma over the cliff. That's ridiculous.
No.
But we had clean air in 2007. We had safe cars in 2007. We have the facts to prove it. But what we didn't have in 2007 is about...
I mean, I don't know about the air in North Carolina, but the air out here in Los Angeles is so much worse now than it was even a year ago. It's incredible.
What do you think the cause of that is, Roland?
Just a lot of cars.
Well, I agree with you. Cars sitting on the freeways, idling away at 15 miles an hour. I've watched it. I used to take off from Burbank Airport. What was that?
I said, well, I had a dead stop where you can't even go anywhere for half an hour.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? I used to get up in the morning and take my flying lessons out of Burbank. I'd fly over around Fox for an hour and fly back to Burbank, and the smog would come in through the pass into the valley, and you couldn't find the airport.
What? If you think it was bad, I don't know when that was. Was that a while back?
Yes, that was a long while back. That was way back in the olden days. It was in 1969 when I was taking flying lessons out of Burbank.
I don't even want to fly. You'd have to have... flying at night. Okay, it's not bad sometimes. I mean, the smog packs in over in Burbank in Glendale, and it's blown into that area. So thick sometimes, it's just like you stick a fork in it.
I know. I took off, and it was crystal clear, and when I got back an hour later, visibility was 1,200 feet. So I literally had to approach the airport on instruments, and I was only a VFR, student.
It's instrument flying going there, bought me after it. In the morning time, it's not quite so bad, but by noon, it's really set in. By the end of the afternoon, it's really heavy.
That's true, because the wind reverses. In the nighttime, it blows out to sea. Somewhere around noon, it reverses because the land heats up and the ocean's now cooler, and so the winds reverse, and all that crap that's blown out to sea turns around and blows right back in against the mountains and just sits there.
Yep, and then they can pile a little more in there.
Yeah, few hundred million more cylinders cranking away. That's one of the reasons why our electric vehicles would be so beneficial out there. Because when you're sitting there doing, then you're using no energy at all.
Right. I mean, even the hybrids, you know, anything is a plus here. Okay, just it's been so long and they just won't let anything come in and really take effect.
Well, they will, but they make the price of them so high because of all the regulations with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. Nobody can afford them, or the majority can't afford them. So the masses drive the engines that burn a lot of gas, and at that point, you put more pollution up in the air.
So what do you think of the idea of the Congress or the President approving the use of drones over domestic property?
Oh, I heard that when I was first calling you. I don't even want to go there yet. I got to do some research on that. What is that about?
Well, right now there is an approval process underway to allow 30,000 drones to fly over the United States. Now, that's 600 drones per state, but you're not going to use them over Hawaii or Rhode Island or probably Alaska. But you are going to use it over the main, you know, flyover country in the main cities. So it's going to be more than 600 drones per state, maybe 630, 640 drones for some states. That's a lot of drones, Roland. That's a lot of drone pilots.
Rick, what's the purpose of these drones?
Number one is to make money. They will be riding traffic tickets like never before. They'll be taking the highway patrolmen and just stacking and racking them. And doing nothing but picking up people that drones have photographed.
Oh, my God.
That's to make money. And the drones.
Big Brother on steroids, man. That's incredible.
I explain in my book, Alienated Nation, that there are two types of weapons. There are lethal weapons that are designed to kill people and break things. And there are shock weapons. Now, lethal weapons are designed to win wars. They're designed to defeat enemies. But shock weapons are designed to make men obey. And we know drones are going to be applied as a shock weapon.
Right. Because then, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about people right now. They can't afford anything. A lot of the people I know are in deep, dire straits right now. And they're barely hanging in there. So all of a sudden they get a traffic ticket for $600, which is not uncommon out here. Okay, those traffic tickets, even parking tickets, are like $350 and up. So you start handing tickets to people for $600 for a speeding violation or something on a highway. Those people that are commuting those long distances, they're gonna be dead in the water. They're not gonna be able to afford it. They're not gonna be able to keep their jobs. They're gonna lose their houses. They're gonna lose their cars.
And you know what happens? People go with the flow of traffic. And if traffic is speeding, the drone can catch everybody. Everybody. Right. They can photograph all the license plates and give them all to the highway patrol. And as I said, they'll just pull them over, huge lines of them, and write them tickets. Now, after the law enforcement gets done with you, then the insurance company is going to spank that rash for another year.
Exactly. Because your insurance rates will go sky high because you got a ticket.
That's correct.
It's a vicious circle.
Well, it's all designed to make money.
Let's make a wish for mass transit here.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Trying to push us out of our cars and into mass transit so the government control us even more.
Well, they can't do that in L.A., there isn't. They have no mass transit. They have the RTD, and they have what they call the Metro, and I mean, even though it's somewhat affected the Metro, it still relies you to hop on a bus to get all kinds of different places. And the city is so huge, it's going to be almost impossible for them to build a real transit system that works.
When I used to surf when I was young, I lived in Pasadena, and the beach was in Santa Monica, 26 miles away. So for a while, I was driving it, but that was a lot of driving, you know, in the early 70s to go down and surf. So I started riding it on my 10-speed, towing my surfboard on a little two-wheel adapter that I'd made on the back of my bike. I could leave at the same time the bus left San Marino, and I could beat the bus to Santa Monica on my 10-speed.
I believe it. That's our transit system. Nothing finer. as long as you have the entire day to get to where you're going, you're fine.
That's right. That's right. Well, the bus had to stop at every single bus stop, and I didn't. I just rolled on. So I actually beat the bus to Santa Monica, and I was in magnificent shape.
I bet you were, man. That's why I did exercise. My thing is, I don't know if you want to exercise quite that hard now with the smog level the way it is.
I know. You know, I grew up in asthma, and we used to have exercise alerts where you could do no physical activity outside because of the smog.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. When I was a kid, they used to have what was called days. So the parents were told, that was after the 1959 nuclear reactor sodium meltdown of the nuclear reactor Rocketdyne. And it lasted for approximately 4 years. They would say, you know, don't let the kids out because it's red eye days, heavy smog, and, you know, all kinds of weird things. You couldn't breathe right. It lasted for probably 3 to 4 years. And that was from 59 to 60, 62, maybe 63.
And we wonder why, you know, kids were affected with asthma and they had so many respiratory problems in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, then catalytic converters got invented in 75. They became mandatory. Of course, it took another 20, 25 years to get all the cars that didn't have catalytic converters off the road. There's still quite a few of them on the road. And now we're to a point, here we are, 2012, I'd say 85% of the vehicles have catalytic converters on them that are functioning. And so, by and large, the air is cleaner. But there are a lot more cars on the road, too.
Right. That's the whole problem. It's cleaner because the bad elements in the air are invisible, so you really can't see them. The stuff that you can see isn't quite as bad as the stuff you can't see. At least that's my understanding. The problem is, you add twice as many cars, and even though you have a better catalytic conversion system on, you double the amount of cars, you're right back where you started.
Well, on any given day, there are about 90 million people commuting to work in the United States. That's 9 million cars on the road at one time in the morning and in the evening. That's not counting all the leisure drivers, trucks, and RVs and stuff like that. This is just commuters.
Right.
That's really the market for electric vehicles. You take the person that's driving the same route every day from home to work. He drives 25 miles one way or 16 miles one way to work. That's the perfect market for electric vehicles. That's what they were designed for.
Right. And they got the stations out here to plug them in.
Yeah, but the problem is between the FDA and the NHTSA, they have kept electric vehicles off the road. Government regulations are doing everything they can to block electric cars from the highway.
I believe it. You know, there's something there that's causing it to where these companies can't come out with the manufactured electric. Because the technology's been there for a long time.
Yeah, it's been there since the mid-90s. But you have two giant agencies that are dedicated to protecting the major car makers, and they're keeping all the independents off the road.
Well, until that breaks down a little bit, where they allow the manufacture and production of the electric cars and the sale of them, I don't know what. You're just writing Congress? You keep helping companies that are trying to produce those cars? You keep tagging on the back of letters, or what do you do?
Well, you go to trade shows, you go to congressional business summits, you bring the vehicle with you, you show them the vehicle, and you say, this is what we make, come and take a ride around the Capitol with me, and they do, and they say, wow, this is an amazing vehicle, how long have you had this? Oh, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever. Well, why aren't you selling them? Because the agencies will not allow us to sell them in the United States. We can sell them in South Africa. We can sell them in Asia, we can sell them in India, but we can't sell them here in the U.S., even though it's safer than 95% of the vehicles on the road today. They still will not let them sell in this country.
Wow. That's, you know, that's the way it has to be done. And hopefully these companies are doing that.
Well, we are. Now, of course, we don't have a lobbyist, and we don't have a special interest group, and we're not paying anyone millions of dollars to sit in Washington and wine and dine Congress or pry their way into the agencies like the GSA or the DOE or NHTSA or the EPA. We don't have anybody like that. The major car makers do. They have thousands and thousands of lobbyists in Washington that make sure that the independents never get a foothold. That era has to end. I was actually encouraged. Even though I didn't vote for Obama, I was kind of encouraged when he said, you know, special interests are not going to have a place in my White House. I'm going to make sure that we cut through all this red tape and allow small businesses and innovators to get their products out there. Nothing can be further from reality.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not that atmosphere.
No, it isn't happening. I mean, it's not just me. It's all the independent car makers are going through the same thing.
Right.
They're all going through the same thing.
Yeah, the problem is if they don't allow them in, the big manufacturers probably aren't going to mess with the electric cars right now because there's not enough market, they feel, or they pose that because they don't want there to be a market.
No. Roland, the market is there. Millions of people want electric vehicles. The market is there. The problem is this. There's no win for
them. People want it, but they can't afford it.
Yeah, but if they build an electric vehicle, they're only displacing a gas-powered vehicle they already make.
Right.
They're increasing their market.
Well, that's what I mean. Why does an electric vehicle or a hybrid so much money?
Because the gasoline motor that charges the batteries is so expensive. A Prius, if it was just an electric vehicle, would be probably, you know, a little bit cheaper because you don't have all that switching and complexity between the gasoline motor and the batteries. You just have more batteries. You know, the Leaf is completely 100% made in Japan, and then it's imported into the United States and sold. So they got to pay a tariff on it. That's why it's $35,000. But if they actually made the Leaf in Smyrna, Tennessee, they might be able to sell it for less money in the United States because there wouldn't be a tariff on it. Of course, the one issue is Nissan uses old battery technology that's toxic. And so those batteries cannot be made in the United States. They have to be made in a foreign country. Then they have to be shipped to Canada. Then they have to be shipped into the U.S., to be put into the factory, and they got to be exported the same way. They got to go through Canada and back to the country that they came from for recycling. And it's expensive.
Oh yeah, that's a lot of shipping.
Of course,
so maybe if these companies actually start manufacturing with the products that work here in the U.S. in the U.S., that might help.
Absolutely will. I mean, companies like mine are sitting here ready to hire 500 people, skilled people, good-paying jobs. These aren't part-time jobs, full-time jobs with benefits, building cars, and filling orders. And we've been ready to go to work for 2 years.
Wow. Well, they've got to do something, and they better do it quick, because you know what? It's not getting a lot better out here in the West. It might be getting better back there in North Carolina.
It's better because we have a lower cost of living than you guys do.
Well, that's it. I mean, the cost of living is lower out here than what it was maybe 6 months ago. But the problem is, if that ever starts taking off again, if gas goes up, everybody's going to be right back in a worse position than they were before.
It could be. You have a lot of businesses leaving California.
Well, yeah, the business atmosphere here is so terrible, and the state's in debt, $15.7 billion. I mean, people are just tired of it, I think. You know, they're tired of trying to fight all the regulations here, fight all the licenses and everything else that's involved in business, and they're just saying it's easier to do business somewhere else.
I agree. I mean, we see it all the time, and that's always a problem. I don't know why it is that way, but why it is government can't just say, you know, it's funny, you hear them say, well, we have to cut overhead and then we have to raise revenue. Well, mm-hmm. you don't need higher taxes, and that's, of course, what they mean by raise revenue. And I wish right. some politician would have the grow a set and say, when that is said to them, we need to cut overhead and raise revenue, turn right around and say, yes, you're exactly right. But the solution is not higher taxes. It's more taxpayers. We got to put right. people to work. When you put people to work, you get more taxpayers. That's where the revenue
yeah,
comes.
Higher wages, they pay a little higher taxes. You know, it'd be a nice thing for everyone.
Great well, job. Over 60%.
There's a concept, create some jobs.
And not government yeah. jobs. Private sector jobs.
No. Create private industry jobs.
Let us go to work. We want to go to work. Just get out of our way.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've done it to the point where everything is so regulated now by everything. At least here in California, there is no real job. I mean, the manufacturing there is so limited here. And I don't see it coming back. I don't know. Who wants to bring in a large manufacturing to California when you can go somewhere like Texas or Arizona or probably even Nevada and do it so much easier?
It is easier. There's no question about it. But when you look at the companies that are in the news, Tesla, Fisker, Wind Generation, Solyndra, and you look at their mm-hmm. stories, the ones that have failed, you know why they failed? They ran out of money because they were delayed for years by government regulations.
If right, the regulations drain them down to nothing.
That's right. If the regulations had not been there, they would have been able to make their solar panels 3 years ago, which would have given them the revenues to succeed.
Right. You know, there's a company, I believe it's out of Arizona. I think it's called Sun Solar. Have you ever heard of them?
I have.
Sun Solar, I believe they're making panel fields.
Right, they're making solar power.
They have a 66 megawatt one out in Lancaster, California. They have a 550 megawatt, I think it is, up there in central, like up around San Luis Obispo, I believe. But I heard they're building one that's almost 600 megawatt over in Arizona.
I've driven by the one in Southern California. It is phenomenal to look at. It's a wonderful facility.
Yeah, I mean, they could put a lot more of those. But the problem is, and my understanding is, Warren Buffett's actually put the money in that company. So there's people there with the will. But, again, is the regulations holding them back to where they can't get installed everywhere?
Absolutely. And it's all the litigation, the lawsuits that are filed by the various regulations and the fights that these companies have to go through in court. They got to spend a bunch of money on lawyers. They got to spend a bunch of money on paperwork and studies and regulations that they have to meet, or they got to pay huge fines. I mean, the EPA wants us to put a label on electric vehicles called a fuel economy label. Well, drivers don't.
A label for what?
It's a fuel economy label for electric vehicles. Now, drivers don't understand the label. It's meaningless to them. There are 14 different numbers on there. And even I can't understand what most of them mean. They're meaningless to the consumer. But if you don't put that label on your vehicle, get this. It's a $32,000 fine per vehicle.
Oh, no.
There's
a way for them to crash the company.
And there's only one location in the entire country that does the testing in Ann Arbor, Michigan. There's only one company that does it. And you cannot appeal their results. If they test your vehicle.
Really? So whenever they come up with a result, is a result, and there's no way to go around and even have anybody else check.
That's correct.
Oh, wow.
And they won't tell you what the testing protocol is. It's classified. They won't tell you how much it costs, and they won't tell you how long it takes. You just send them a vehicle, and they send you a bill.
You send them a vehicle and you pay whatever they say. That's almost like extortion.
It is, absolutely.
Unbelievable.
Well,
they definitely don't want those cars on the road, do they?
No, they definitely do not.
Unbelievable.
Listen, it's at the top of the hour, Roland. I really appreciate the call, as always. We always appreciate
you. Have a great week, okay?
Thank you very much.
And I wish you the best, my friend.
Thank you, and happy Father's Day, my friend.
Thank you. You too.
All right, my friends, that's second hour in the can for X Squared Radio. I love the interaction because at least you get to hear about the terrible things that are going on out there in the business community. And if you're a politician or if you are a candidate for a political office, listen closely, because what you hear on this program in this last hour is happening. It's real. This isn't fake. This isn't made up. This is what's really happening in the business community. It's what's really killing business in this country. This is the cause. This is the reason why business is failing in the United States and why it is blossoming in third world countries. Exactly what we're talking about here. Let's take a quick break, a little Muse uprising, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. right, a little uprising from Muse, third hour, X Squared Radio. June 17, 2012, this is the auspicious year. Next Sunday will be the last Sunday of spring, and we'll be headed officially into summer. The summer solstice will be upon us. And when the winter solstice occurs, December 21st, 2012, guess where we are going to be? We're going to be at Chichen Itza, ground zero of the Maya legend, the reset of the great Maya calendar, with power places, Greg Braid, Marine St. Germain, and others, and myself. You can be there with us. Very easy. All you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the orange banner, Maya 2012, and join us. We're leaving on the 13th, coming back on the 22nd. I promise to have you home by Christmas. And man, will you have the stories to tell. Your life will be changed. Your perspective on this planet and your involvement and knowledge about the Maya calendar and what this whole 2012 thing is all about will be yours forever. And you'll be able to share it with your progeny. And we think it's a great idea. So go there and click on the banner and get involved. If you don't have a passport, if you don't want to travel internationally, you can click on the blue banner at xsquaredradio.com. That's the Pythagoras Conference, and that's a couple months earlier in October, Southern Indiana. Now you're talking a conference in the Midwest. Now you're talking one you don't have to fly to, you don't have to have a passport, and it's very affordable. In fact, when you click on that blue banner, you're going to get $100 off. That is the best deal in the country for going to a conference of this quality. We never have conferences of this size and quality and scope in the Midwest. They're always out on the West Coast, which means you have to travel to them, got to pay for a rental car, got to pay for a hotel, got to pay for all your meals, blah, blah, blah. Now you don't have to do any of that, because this is going to be at a great resort in Southern Indiana. Click on the Pythagoras Conference banner and find out. Now, some. By the way, we encourage you to be part of the program. This is the final hour, 888-429-5471. We have lots of new listeners. As you know, last Wednesday we were on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie talking about my latest book, Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. Each chapter in that book has been driving the national headlines like a precision hammer. You'll know it when you read the book. You'll know it when you listen to the bonus free audiobook that comes to you if you buy it from our website at alienatednation.com. If you buy it from Amazon, you're going to get a great price, you're going to get a quick delivery, but it won't come autographed and you don't get the audio version. So it doesn't matter to me either way. If you do buy it from Amazon, do me a favor. Do me a favor, the hundreds of you that have purchased it from Amazon in the last few days. Would you go back to Amazon and write a good review? It helps us out. It doesn't cost you a dime. Take 5 minutes of your time. Write a short paragraph of how much you enjoyed the book. I've already gotten your emails. I know how you're enjoying it. Just take 5 minutes. Take the body of your email, cut and paste it into a book review on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it will help us out a lot. Thank you. Thank you so much for responding to this great information. Lots happening in political science now. I don't want to talk about the presidential campaign because you get that all the time. What I do want to talk about are the things that are happening on the grassroots level. For instance, what you have heard in the news, but you haven't heard the details of, is that North Dakota voters are voting to end their property tax. Are you kidding me? We haven't ended property tax since the 1700s. What are you doing up there in Bismarck, North Dakota? Well, since Californians shrank their property taxes more than three decades ago by passing, you remember the famous Proposition 13, what was happening is people that had purchased their homes in the 50s, 60s, 70s for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 now saw their little 1,200 square foot houses worth $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, and they don't want to sell. They live in California because they love California. Their house is paid for. Why would they want to move? They retired there. They worked there. The kids were born there. Why would they want to move? Well, the reason is because California kept jacking the property taxes on them. So a $40,000 house now worth $700,000, you're paying a 1% tax. That's $7,000 a year, which is, yeah, you got it, $600 a month. Heck, I didn't have that much of a house payment when I bought the house. And so what happened is voters, because California has a unique state legislature that allows voters to put propositions onto the main election ballot, drafted and proposed a Proposition 13, which took their taxes back to the level they were when they bought the home. Now, if you sell the home, then the new sale price becomes the basis upon which the taxes are calculated. But the old sale price, the original sale price, is the basis on which the sales tax was, a property tax was calculated. So around the country, people have echoed their dismay over such levies, putting forth plans to even them, simplify them, cap them, and even slash them. And in an election in North Dakota on Tuesday of last week, residents of North Dakota will consider a measure that reaches far beyond any of that. One that abolishes the property tax entirely. Why would they do such a thing? You got any ideas? You can share it with us. 888-429-5471. My ideas are that oil has become such a huge revenue. Oil properties, oil leases, oil revenues have become such a huge source of tax revenue for North Dakotans, those people in the north country of NODAC, that they don't need property taxes anymore. And so the state, rather than saying, oh my gosh, look at all this new revenue we have, let's increase spending. And that's not what they said. What they said was, just like Susan Beeler, I would like to be able to know that my home, no matter what happens to my income or my life, is not going to be taken away from me because I can't pay a tax. Well, the Constitution, they're going to amend the state constitution. This isn't a law. They're going to amend the state constitution to end the property tax. They argue that the tax is unpredictable, inconsistent, counter to the concept of property ownership, and needless in a state that, thanks in part to wildly successful oil drilling, and will be for a long, long time, probably another 50 years, finds itself in the rare circumstance of carrying budget reserves. Don't say that too loud, Ms. Beeler, because the federal government will be along shortly. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised that these large reserves of oil are not nationalized by the federal government. An unusual coalition of forces, including the North Dakota Chamber of Commerce and the state's largest public employees unions, vehemently oppose the idea of abolishing the property tax, arguing that such a ban would upend this quiet capital. Some big unanswered questions, the opponents say, include precisely how lawmakers would make up some $812 million in annual property tax revenue. Well, seeing as how there's only 812 people living in North Dakota, I think it'd be pretty easy. What effect the change would have on hundreds of other state laws and regulations that allude to the more than a century-old property tax, and what decisions would be left for North Dakota cities, counties, and other governing boards if, say, they wanted to build a new school, hire more police, or open a new park. I told you, with all this newfound revenue, we have to have newfound spending to go with it. I mean, come on, people. We got all this money. We can't just let it lay around. We got to spend it. We can't have a surplus. Are you crazy? We got to come up with stuff to spend it on. This is a plan without a plan, said Andy Peterson, president and chairman of the North Dakota Chamber of Commerce, who acknowledged that property taxes have climbed in some parts of the state and that North Dakota's political leaders need to tackle the issue. But he goes on to say, but this solution is a little like giving a barber a razor-sharp butcher knife. And by the way, the barber's blind, and asking him or her to give you a haircut Well, you'll get the job done, but you might be missing an ear or an eye. Oh, that sounds like a typical thing a North Dakota politician would say. Not that I'm trying to make fun of my former NODAC neighbors. You know, I was stationed in the tropical paradise of Grand Forks, North Dakota, when I was in the Air Force. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I enjoyed sub-zero weather for 4 months up there. Yes, I tried cross-country skiing and learned to play hockey, and I went to the Spud Bar in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Come on. Come on, I know what it's all about. But you got revenues that are coming in that this state has never seen before. You got enough oil revenues to take care of the state for the next 100 years. There's no sense coming up with more spending programs for North Dakota. Why don't you keep the spending programs you have and return the wealth to the people that own the property in the state? Return the sales tax to them and let them keep their homes and tax the oil that's coming from the ground underneath. It's the right thing to do. Any state would do it that was ethical. Polls conducted last month and last week suggest that voters here overwhelmingly oppose the ballot measure to ban the property tax. Utter and complete nonsense. They absolutely support the ban on property tax. They don't. The only people that would oppose it are renters, you buffoons. You have a professional voter class in your state, too, and they rent. And people that rent don't give a crap about property tax. They want the people that own the apartment building or the basement or the duplex or quadplex that they live in. They want them to pay the tax. But they're not paying because they pay rent. Still, even if the measure here fails, in North Dakota fails on Tuesday, the notion is picking up steam in some Republican circles in other states, including North Carolina, Texas, and Pennsylvania. Here's a quote from Jim Cox, a state representative in Pennsylvania. No tax should have the power to leave you homeless. He's proposed legislation to eliminate the school property tax in the state, where he said such taxes have led residents to losing their homes to sheriff sales, entering into reverse mortgages, or simply moving away. You've heard the reverse mortgage commercials on TV, haven't you? Mr. Fred Thompson saying, I'm sure you're confused, but I'm a national celebrity and a former presidential candidate and senator of Tennessee. You can trust me. Remortgage your house through a reverse mortgage. What this basically means is instead of paying your house off, you're going to use the equity in your home, and we're going to turn those house payments in reverse, and we're going to start paying you each month. And sure enough, in a given amount of time, guess what? Your house is going to be completely mortgaged again. That's right. Instead of paying it off, you're going to be loading it up with debt. And when it's finally maxed out, no problem. We can foreclose on it, the bank will take it, and the government will bail out the bank. Isn't that a wonderful system? You can trust me. I'm Fred Thompson. Well, Jim Cox sees the problem exactly. Now, it can be said that if you're retired or you're childless or you're a college student and you buy a home or blah, 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 you're paying the school property tax and you don't have a kid in the fight. You don't have a kid in school, so why should you pay the school property tax? Well, I want to tell you that argument does not hold water, and if you're making it, you should stop immediately, because the kids that are in school will become useful, educated, productive members of your community. It is an investment in your community, whether you have kids or not. Paying for those schools is a good idea. And in each county, everywhere in this country, 60 to 70% of the entire county budget goes to pay for those schools. Yes, they do get some federal money, but not much. Most of the money comes from you guys, You guys that own homes, you guys that own apartment complexes, you guys that own shopping centers, you're paying the school tax through your property taxes. But the reason you're paying is because those schools must be supported with revenue. Now, what a lot of states have done is they've lied to their residents and said, hey, let's start a new source of revenue. Let's start a tax on the poor and the stupid. Well, okay, they don't call it that. They call it the lottery. It's a tax, though, on the poor and the stupid. Instead of levying the tax against them and taking their money, you simply market to them the opportunity that, hey, if you don't play, you can't win. And guess what they'll do? You got it. They'll go right down to the minute mark, and they'll pay the tax voluntarily. And pay they do. And so the money, millions of dollars each month, come pouring into the state, and it makes up that school budget. But while that money is used for the school, guess what the state can do with the money they were going to spend on the schools? That's right. They can spend it anywhere they want. They can spend it on a new tourist attraction. They can spend it on a new park. They can spend it on an expansion to state buildings. That's right. They can give raises to executives and to administrators all across the state. But all they're doing is using the tax on the poor and the stupid to make up the money that they're taking from the budget and spending on other things. They're not improving schools. Almost all states that have lotteries are spending no more on their schools than they were spending before the lottery. Most states have lotteries now, and some states have multi-state lotteries, and they're now marketing them online. So they're expanding their marketing campaigns to other states. For a long time, Tennessee did not have a lottery. We had to drive up to Kentucky. And so when I worked at Nissan, there were security guards that would get off work, drive up to the Kentucky border, buy a whole series of lottery tickets for various people that had given them money at the plant in a big accordion file, and then they would bring the lottery tickets back, distribute them throughout the plant. People would scratch them off or play the numbers the following Wednesday night. And one night, in the years that I was there, one night somebody won about $30,000. You would have thought that they won $30 million. At that point, we had about 6,000 employees at Nissan, and that guy couldn't even hold all the money in his truck driving up to Kentucky the next week. It started a feeding frenzy that lasted for months. I'm just telling you, you might not be poor, and you might not be stupid, but chances are you're one of the two, because lots of people play that lottery. I've played it about three or four times only because office mates have talked me into buying a $2 ticket. And I might as well have taken the $2 and slipped it out the window while I was driving down the road. It would have gone to a better cause. In a way, North Dakota, though 48th in population among the states, was a logical place for such a movement to brew. While the state's property tax collections per capita generally fall near the middle among states, the surge in oil production over the past 5 years, mainly in the western portion of the state over by Fargo, has seen its effects ripple through other parts of life in the state. The state's coffers are full, overflowing even. Assessments of home values, especially in some areas, have risen drastically, too. The political mood in North Dakota leans toward Republican. They dominate Bismarck, which is the state capital. Small government, little intrusion, and fiscal conservatism. Though opponents to the property tax here receive a $12,000 donation in 2010 from the American Tax Reduction Movement, a sister group to the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which grew out of California's Proposition 13. Members say the efforts here were largely organic, the result of unhappy property taxpayers getting fed up. No kidding. The same problem kept coming up, said Charlene Nelson, a homemaker who became a leader of the effort aimed to amend the Constitution. pointing to what she deems the underlying problem with the property tax. Here's what she says. It means all of us renters, none of us are homeowners. In recent years, state officials sent more money to localities to pay for schools in an effort to lower property tax bills. But opponents of the property tax said those efforts did not go nearly far enough and collected nearly 30,000 signatures on petitions to bring the matter to ballot. Those who wanted to keep the property tax have vastly outraised the opponents, gathering more than $500,000 in campaign finance reports show this. Although the question is among four on the ballot on Tuesday, including the highly contentious question of whether the University of North Dakota should give up its Fighting Sioux nickname, residents here said they have been deluged with information about the property tax measure on signs, radio talk shows, and through months of debates in school gymnasiums and recreation halls like Edgley and Bowman. For his part, Governor Jack Dalrymple, a Republican, said he opposed the property tax ban. "It's mind-boggling, really," he said in an interview, "of the effects of such a ban. We'd be changing everything, frankly." Yes, you would, Governor. You would be, instead of 48th in population, you would be number one in conservatism. Imagine the history that you could establish. Imagine the change that you could establish. Everything you do eventually affects the universe, Governor. You might as well do it on purpose. The notion, he said, that the state has enough surplus to replace property taxes for localities around the state without raising other taxes is false. For starters, he said, much of the state's benefits from the oil boom are already dedicated legally to particular funds and cannot simply be transferred to support schools, counties, towns, park districts, and the like. Sorry, but my BS detector is going off full blast, Governor. You would take lottery money and apply to the schools, but you take the money that was going to the schools and you would apply it to any project you want. You can move money anywhere you want, and you know it. Even if the ban fails, North Dakota lawmakers now seem all but certain to tackle broader solutions to the property tax question as early as next year. The governor says, "I have to say that we totally understand that North Dakotans are very concerned about their property tax payments. You have attention there, and people say this can't keep on." Spoken like a true politician and nowhere even close to a solution. Mr. Dalrymple should be replaced. Property owners unite. Just because you own property does not mean that you are taxed into oblivion by your government to pay for services. You have a revenue engine. It's called oil. Take advantage of it. Use it for what it's meant for, and pay for everything with your wonderful bounty for the next 50 years. You don't need to build North Dakota into one of the largest populations in the state just because you have a lot of money. You have a surplus. Don't say that too loudly, because the Treasury will be along shortly. These states that have large oil reserves and go after them, don't be surprised if the government doesn't make a move to nationalize that oil. I say capitalize on it while you can. Get your property owners healed. If you don't repeal the property tax, cut it back to about one penny on the thousand instead of a dollar on the thousand. Cut it back to where people are paying $50 a year for property tax. Do a reset on your property tax. Take advantage of that wealth and return it to the people who it belongs to, the landowners. Okay. You have heard us talk about the X-37B on this program many times. We talked about it when it launched. We talked about it when it changed orbits mysteriously. You remember Heavens Above was tracking it, and then they lost it. They lost it because it changed orbits. It changed altitude. But then they found it again, and they kept tracking it. And then they said it was landing, and then it didn't land, and it just landed. The X-37B orbital test vehicle has finally returned to Earth. It landed early Saturday morning at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California after weather conditions kept pushing back landing attempts the past few days. The Air Force's, now keep in mind, this used to be NASA's. NASA designed the X-37B as a robotic unmanned space shuttle, but NASA's budget kept getting cut every year, and so the project ran out of money and they were going to scrap it. But it showed such promise. It was so wonderful. So the Air Force moved in and put it under its rapid deployment program. That's fancy language for an unlimited, unreportable budget. And so the Air Force was able to throw an undisclosed amount of money to undisclosed functions to get the X-37B ready for its undisclosed classified missions. So the Air Force's X-37B is an unmanned reusable spacecraft built by Boeing that has spent more than a year on a classified mission in space. Oh yeah, we don't know what was in the bay. We don't know what it was doing. We know it's solar powered. It has a solar panel that it can deploy out of the cargo bay. It's sort of like a miniature space shuttle with no windows in it. But we don't know what it was carrying. We don't know what it deployed. It measures 29 feet in length. It has a 15-foot wingspan. The unmanned reusable X-37B looks like the retired space shuttles, a little shorter and a little narrower. It landed at 5:48 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time after spending 469 days in orbit. It could have gone more, of course, but I think the Air Force was just pushing it to its limits to see what it would do. That's my personal opinion. I'm not basing that on any kind of reports. The craft went up March 5th, and it came back this last Saturday, March 5th, 2011, and came back this last Saturday. It has led to speculation that a spacecraft is involved in intelligence gathering operations or the testing of new technologies. And you know the folks down at Wars R Us have lots of money for new technologies. Weapon systems and systems that can be used to support weapon systems get most of the money from the Defense Department, all unmarked budgets, all tactical stuff. In keeping with the scarce mission details for the X-37B, all the Air Force would say in a statement Saturday was that the spacecraft had conducted on-orbit experiments during its mission. Lieutenant Colonel Tom McIntyre, the X-37B program manager, said, "With the retirement of the space shuttle fleet, the X-37B OTV program brings a singular capability to the space technology development," he added. The return capability allows the Air Force to test new technologies without the same risk commitment faced by other programs. But in other words, you don't have to let it burn up in the atmosphere. You don't have to take a missile and shoot it out of the sky so that a high-resolution camera or a fuel source lands in the wrong hands. "We're proud of the entire team's successful efforts to bring this mission to an outstanding conclusion," he said. Even the initial announcement about the upcoming landing details kept the details vague. A May 30th Air Force statement said the spacecraft would return to Earth in the early to mid-June time frame, so we really didn't have a heads up this thing was going to land. Designed to stay in extended Earth orbits, the X-37B remained in orbit for 224 days during its maiden mission in 2010. This mission kept it in orbit more than twice as long this time around. An Air Force statement announcing Saturday's landing says the X-37B will launch again later this fall aboard an Atlas V booster. We have video of the X-37B landing, but there was no audio with it, so I'm not gonna bother you with that. It's important that you know about these weapon systems that are being deployed by the Air Force. They're not up there for their health. They're not up there because it's fun to do. They're up there because they have a specific mission they're trying to accomplish. And the thing that's important to them is that they have a reusable space machine now that they can take technology to space, run it, run their surveillance, run telescopes, run all kinds of equipment, be it cameras or scanners or whatever, or even, you know, targeted weapon systems that they can drop out of orbit onto a target, and then they can return the craft to Earth. They can also go up and get stuff with their robotic arm, put it in the cargo bay, and bring it home. So it gives us a lot of flexibility, and we'll see how the Air Force and NASA work together to make it work. Now, from time to time, you hear us talk about energy. And, of course, you've heard the last couple of administrations talk about cap and trade. A lot of people don't know what that is, but let me just basically describe it to you. What they're trying to do is create a currency. It's sort of like printing money, except it's printed in the form of carbon credits. And the carbon credits in the form of certificates or energy credits. Now, polluters, they get fined, unless, of course, they can buy energy credits from companies that make credits. For instance, let's say you're a solar power company, or you're a wind power company, or you're an electric car company, or you make some kind of green technology that creates the credits. In order to create benefit for your company, you can sell those renewable fuel credits through a broker to a company that pollutes, like, say, a coal-fired power plant. So the power plant can take the credits that they buy for a discount, and they can trade them so they don't get fined fines for putting the CO2 in the atmosphere. And you know that once a new currency is created, that sooner or later, somebody's going to figure out how to counterfeit it. Well, that's exactly what this article is about. It's an Associated Press article by Alex Dominguez. A Maryland man has been accused of, you got it, selling bogus energy credits. Can you imagine that? I told you this was going to happen. A Maryland man faces trial in a $9.1 million fraud case that is shedding light on problems in a renewable energy credits program run by, guess what, the U.S. EPA. Federal prosecutors accused Rodney Haley of Perry Hall of selling renewable energy credits, even though his company, Clean Green Fuel LLC, did not produce any renewable fuel. Instead, prosecutors say he pocketed the money and bought Ferraris and other luxury cars, as well as tractor trailers, homes, jewelry, and computers. Oh, sure. Go figure. Mr. Perry Hall, Mr. Rodney Haley of Perry Hall, you're stupid. You could have done it. Jury selection is scheduled to begin in the case Monday in U.S. District Court. If Haley is convicted, prosecutors are seeking forfeiture of the $9.1 million, including the cars, homes, and other items, of which nearly $3 million has been recovered, said Marcia Murphy, a spokeswoman for the U.S. Attorney's Office. Now, the reason that this article is important isn't so much that somebody was out there faking it out by printing up these nice certificates and selling it to companies who are willing to pay $9.1 million for them. That's not the real story here. The real story here is that the currency actually exists. The real story here is the EPA, the way they write regulations. The way they write regulations is they use the court system. Okay? It is technically called litigious legislation. Now, what that means is that the EPA uses litigation. They use court cases, and they win court cases in a very strategic manner. In other words, they only take on court cases they know they can win, and they know they can win them in a big way, and they get a big settlement, and then they use that court case as a precedent, as an example, to file another case, and then another one, and another one. And from these cases, they're able to write regulations because obviously, we cannot let this happen again. So we got to write regulations to prevent it from happening. And we use the court cases as the basis for writing the regulations, the statutes, okay? These regulations have the force of law. This is the real story, okay? Mr. Rodney Haley has played right into the EPA's hands by giving them a slam dunk, easy case that they can win with no problem with a jury. And now they can use this case as a precedent to write new regulations, giving them new power over, guess what? That's right, green fuel, renewable fuel providers that are providing the certificates, the fuel credits, the renewable fuel credits. That's what they're doing. They're going after the renewable fuel credits, and they're using court cases like this to regulate it. Joseph Evans, a federal public defender representing Haley, declined comment. Well, you just had my comment, Mr. Evans. The case is one of several nationwide, including similar fraud cases in Texas and Alabama, that have led to calls in Congress for a review of the program. It has also prompted a lawsuit against the EPA by those defrauded by the Maryland company because the federal agency is not recognizing the credits they thought were genuine. Companies that market petroleum in the United States are being required to produce renewable fuels such as biodiesel made from vegetable oils or purchase credits known as renewable identification numbers or RINs from producers of those fuels to satisfy the requirement designed to increase clean energy. In Congress, Republican leaders of the House Energy and Commerce Committee say the EPA's management of the situation appears to have made a bad situation worse, punishing innocent participants who were defrauded. And that's exactly right. Because after the EPA confiscates the $9.1 million that they're going to recover from Mr. Rodney Haley, where do you think that money goes? That's right. He has to forfeit the money and the cars and the homes and the other items, and the EPA gets to keep it. So the companies that put up the money, that bought the Ferraris and the homes and the other items, the tractor trailers and such, they don't get their money back. No. The EPA has expenses. We'll take care of the money. You guys were defrauded, and it's buyer beware. Well, interesting. Representatives Fred Upton, Republican from Michigan, and Ed Whitfield, Republican from Kentucky, said this. As a result, the risk of unknowingly buying problematic RINs, okay, these are the renewable credits, is great. And so the renewable fuels marketplace is in turmoil. That was in a letter earlier this year to an EPA official about problems in the program. The EPA says, program, and by the way, Mr. Ed Whitfield has a biodiesel plant outside of Owensboro, Kentucky, that crushes soybeans and makes biodiesel. It also makes it from other vegetable oils that are brought in by rail car. It isn't particularly profitable, but it is one of the more productive biodiesel plants in the Midwest. Of course, we built or involved in building a biodiesel plant up in Washington State that crushes canola seed and camelina seed and makes biodiesel. And it's marginally profitable as well, but only because the co-ops own it and they're able to have a sale place to sell their canola, which they don't have if they sell it to Canada because they have to pay all the money in shipping. So it does provide a service. But biodiesel market didn't turn out to be what it was supposed to be, and you know why. Oh, you don't? Well, I'm going to tell you. It's because the EPA issued letters that biodiesel was actually more polluting than petroleum diesel, and it caused biodiesel to stop being purchased by several municipalities across the country. And the EPA has been actively opposing the biodiesel board on several different levels, including blending regulations. Oh, you want to know about those? Okay, here you go. Biodiesel, according to the EPA, is not considered to be a fuel. It's considered to be an additive. Well, that makes it quite different, because states that want to put in pumps, metering pumps, that can use, say, a biodiesel tank and a petroleum tank and blend the fuel at the pump before it goes into the tank, they can't do it, because the EPA will not allow additives to be added to the fuel at the pump. They must be splash blended, which means if you want to sell B20, B10, B5, B2, you have to have a tank for each one of those blends. You got to pour in 20% biodiesel and 80% petroleum diesel, stir it up, and that's what you sell. The problem is that the cost of the tanks and the containments to hold those tanks is prohibitive for most stations. It takes up real estate. They have to pay fees and fines and all kinds of things for the containments to put them in and to monitor the tanks and the emissions, fugitive emissions from those tanks. And it's not worth it to them. So they don't carry the biodiesel. They can't sell it. But if those states could say in their legislation that biodiesel was actually a fuel and not an additive, then they could blend it at the pump in a much more precise way, by the way. They could have B100 in one tank, rack petroleum in another tank, and the buyer simply selects the blend at the pump. They swipe their card, press B2, B5, B10, B20, and it pumps the blend, metering it right into their tank, blends it through a static mixer right in the nozzle, and it goes right into the tank as a perfect homogeneous blend. But the EPA blocks that, and that's why there's no market for biodiesel. And that's why these fuel credits become the back-end lawsuit. They're actually taking the money from the companies that are buying the carbon credits, and they're stealing the money. And that is your EPA at work, keeping renewable fuels off the market by penalizing the stations and penalizing the people that buy it. A consortium responsible for assuring the validity of the credits is also being discussed by the industry stakeholders, the EPA said. A consortium means a new bureau, a new agency, a new division of the EPA is going to be created to monitor the credits. In other words, they're the ones that are going to be printing the money. They're going to print the certificates. The EPA's efforts were met with skepticism by George Parcells, an attorney representing Ocean Connect, one of the companies suing the EPA. Nothing's been solved. In fact, there's been a lot of attention on Capitol Hill, and congressmen and senators all making hay with the EPA over the RIN program, Parcells said. You guys have no idea how big this iceberg is. Take it from somebody that's worked in the industry, that knows the industry from the ground up, not the top down, but the ground up. We've already been through the EPA. We've already been through the Department of Environmental Quality in the state of Washington, one of the strictest states in the entire country, and we built a plant that works. But guess what that plant does not sell? It does not sell renewable fuel credits. You want to know why? Because the EPA is too corrupt to manage it. The EPA is solely responsible for stopping renewable fuels from being offered at the pump in the United States. So now you know the fullness of the story. You know what's going on. You want to contact Congressman Ed Whitfield in Kentucky? You want to contact Fred Upton in Michigan? You can do that. Those are two of several of the congressmen that are active in this problem. If you know people that are members of the biodiesel board, if you know people that are members of the consulting teams for the various states, I am for Washington State. I can tell you that we have advocated for pump blending of biodiesel for years and years and years, and the EPA will not allow biodiesel to be classified a fuel. It is technically an additive, and that is how they keep it from being blended in an economic way at the pump. It is strictly, absolutely, positively done to protect the oil company's marketplace at the pump. When the price of diesel gets up to $4 a gallon, which it was for over a year, biodiesel becomes cost-effective in several ways. Here's two that I can name right now. If you're a professional truck driver and you're buying low-sulfur diesel, you're destroying your diesel engine unless you put an additive in the tank. For every 100 gallons of biodiesel that you buy, you need to buy 1 gallon of biodiesel. That's right, that little bottle that you buy at the truck stop that you pour in on top of your fuel is biodiesel. It adds calcium and it adds lubricity back to the fuel that protects your engine. It lowers the emissions. It gives you more power by raising the cetane number. Cetane's like octane in fuel. It gives you more power in the diesel. Well, that biodiesel doesn't cost you $4 a gallon. Oh, no, 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 no. It costs you $9 a quart. That's right, $9 a quart for that biodiesel because of the packaging, shipping, and regulations that are put on it by the EPA. Now, let's say that that trucker bought $100 of fuel at $4 a gallon. That's $400, right? Plus, he put $9 if he puts 1 quart. If he puts a gallon on, it's $36. $36. So now that tank of fuel didn't cost him $400. It cost him $436. That's right. It added 9% to the cost of that fuel. 9%. Biodiesel could be blended with that same diesel and be sold for 10 to 15% less than rack price diesel. He would actually save 20 to 25% on a tank of fuel because he would not have to add the additive. It would already be blended in the fuel. It would actually save billions and billions of dollars in fuel costs if biodiesel could be sold like rack diesel at the pump. If it could be blended at the pump, it would save billions of dollars of cost for the trucking companies, and it would save hundreds of millions of gallons of diesel, and it would reduce the pollution significantly. And who stands in the way of that? You got it. The Environmental Protectionist Agency. That's who stands in the way. So now you know the true story behind what's going on out there. So next week we have the mighty Amit Goswami coming on the program. We're going to headline that through BBS Radio. He is the quantum activist. He is the professor emeritus of physics. And he is coming on the program to talk about his new book. And we'll post the book at the website. We'll have the cover on there so that you can buy it proliferously. He is a fantastic writer. And he's also a magnificent speaker. Hopefully we'll have a good interchange next week, and you can be here right with us on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of the program tonight. Keep those cards and letters coming, and don't forget, if you bought the book, Alienated Nation, you bought it from me, you bought it from Amazon, you bought an audiobook and you listened to it, do me a favor. Go to Amazon and write a review. Those of you that wrote me those wonderful emails this last week, I treasure them. Thank you so much. It made it worth the while to write the book. Go back, open your email, copy the contents of your email, and stick it in Amazon as a book review. You would be helping me out a tremendous amount. This week, we outsold Levin, Hannity. We outsold everybody that's got a book out there in government and civics. We want to stay there. We need your reviews in order to do that. Won't cost you anything but a couple minutes of time. I'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.